Hi, Henry. How are you?
Not too bad. And yourself?
Not too bad. Just making sure that my... Yep, it is indeed capturing my handsome features, so I guess we're ready to go.
Okay, the joys of technology and blogging heads. So I guess this is probably going to be an all-conservative edition of blogging heads.
Well, yes, which is wonderful, because it will enable me to fight on my own ground for a while. Better to defend one's own territory than go out and try and conquer others.
It'll allow me to draw upon my experience of having grown up in a pretty conservative Catholic country and in a relatively conservative part of that Catholic country, so fingers crossed it won't be entirely off home territory.
Well then, why don't, speaking of other countries, why don't we start off with the topic of immigration, where the Senate has just put together what looks like a large, bulky compromise bill that promises to both, in theory at least, regularize the flow of immigrants into the United States, provide some kind of, well, we don't need to call it amnesty because that's a loaded term, but provide some pathway for the millions of illegal immigrants currently in the country to move out of the shadows, as the lingo has it, and also toughen up border security and crack down on employers who hire illegal immigrants, in theory. And so I thought maybe we could start off talking about why this bill is bad for the Republican Party on just about every level.
Well, it's pretty interesting. I think that you pointed to a David Frum piece, and I know that David has been predicting that immigration is going to be the doom of the Republican Party for quite some period, but I think, at least based on the initial soundings, it seems like he's absolutely right. The impression I'm getting is that it really puts the Republicans between a rock and a hard place. Now that I understand it, the effectively what we've seen up until relatively recently is an implicit coalition within the Republican Party between, on the one hand, business-friendly conservatives who don't care all that much about the social issues but are interested in having a cheap labor force which is willing to work sometimes under pretty unpleasant conditions in places like Tar Heel, Carolina. And on the other hand, we have a more socially conservative wing of the Republican Party which has been directly and immediately concerned with immigration, sometimes on legitimate grounds, sometimes on grounds that I, as a lefty, would consider to be pretty problematic. And this this coalition has always been a little bit shaky, but I think it's being brought into the issues are being brought into stark relief by the current deal that's on the table, because what it does is it provides a pathway towards legal status for a whole bunch of immigrants. It also allows for a continued guest worker status for a bunch of new people, which keeps the business side of the Republican Party pretty happy. But the people who I think are going to feel very aggrieved by this are the Lou Dobbs wing, the Tom Tancredo wing, the people who are really sort of vehemently concerned about immigration and who view this as being a fundamental threat to the American way of life. So apart from the innate merits of the issue, and I can talk about that certainly as well, I think it raises some interesting issues for the left, it really puts the Republicans between a rock and a hard place, because on the one hand, their conservative base is clearly pretty angry and upset at this. On the other hand, there's also a strong constituency within the Republican Party which wants a deal which business is going to benefit from. And then finally, I think you see the long-term interests of people like Bush and Karl Rove, who believe that for the long-term benefit of the Republican Party, they need to get Hispanics on board. Many Hispanics are socially conservative in some ways and would seem to be natural allies, but the way that this has been introduced, as the Frum article suggests, is liable to alienate those and perhaps to create a long-term constituency which is vehemently opposed to the Republican Party out of a group of pretty disparate social entities which might otherwise consider themselves not necessarily to have all that much to do with each other.
Well, that sounds about right to me. What I would add to that, I think, is the fact that in the long term, and this is one of the many places where I think the Bush-Rove calculus has gone astray, there's very little reason to think that either current levels of Hispanic immigration from Mexico or higher levels than we have now, which I think is a possibility, will benefit the Republican Party in any way, shape, or form. There have been repeated attempts by people from the White House and supporters of immigration on the conservative side of the aisle to argue that, you know, just as, you know, the Irish and the Italians and so on, all these generations of immigrants eventually went from being reliable Democratic constituencies to being, if not reliable Republican constituents, at least frequent Republican voters, so too will Hispanics follow the same pattern. And I'm sure that that's true. I think that's something that you're likely to see around the year 2035 or so, about 30 years out from the current political landscape. And I think in the short run, you know, I think that the Republicans under George W. Bush have done an impressive job of getting, instead of 25% of the Hispanic vote, 35 to 40% of the Hispanic vote. And I can certainly sympathize with the party's leadership's theory that, you know, yes, you certainly can't dramatically alienate Hispanic voters. The problem is that what this bill probably does is give you the worst of both worlds. As Frum says, it both riles up the base, inspiring nativism and xenophobia within the party, which turns off Hispanic voters, while at the same time increasing the overall numbers of those voters in the electorate. So, yeah, so it seems like a worst of both worlds scenario.
Certainly from the point of view of the Republican Party. But here I actually think that maybe the Karl Rove, and clearly I have no particular insight into Karl Rove's thinking beyond
reading
newspapers. There may be something to what he and Bush were trying to do, which is that I think sooner or later this was going to happen. Sooner or later, this is not a sustainable situation that tens, you know, so that I can't remember the exact figures, at least in the low tens of millions.
12 to 15 million. Yeah,
10 to 15 million people in the U.S. would be illegal immigrants. This clearly is going to have to get resolved one way or the other. And the preferred option of the conservatives, basically to kick them out and send them home, I don't think was going to be, you know, apart from what I would personally view as being pretty reprehensible as a policy, I don't think it was ever going to happen. So from a Rove point of view, you're faced with this electoral bloc, which is sooner or later going to come online, probably sooner rather than later, and at the very least you can seek to do everything that you can in order to mitigate the impact. So perhaps, you know, so what we're seeing here is less a sort of miscalculation on the part of the Rove-Bush axis than the fact that they're too weak to impose their will upon the upon a resurgent and sort of grumpy Republican constituency in the House, composed of conservatives who feel that they've been screwed over the last few years in various ways by the Bush administration. And I don't think that there's any clearly Rove and Bush want a deal. They're prepared to put up with a wide variety of possible deals, but they're not strong enough either on the one hand to influence this deal in ways that would make it more palatable for the conservatives, or on the other hand to get the conservatives to walk in lockstep behind them. So to me, I don't think that this is as much a miscalculation on their part as perhaps you seem to be suggesting. It just seems to me a train wreck which was going to happen for them sooner rather than later. Anyway, they maybe have done what they can to try and mitigate the train wreck, but the fact that they're not able to do very much may have less to do with their miscalculations than with the fact that given where they are politically, they may not have any very good choices.
Well, some of this comes down, I think, to the question of whether it is feasible to reduce levels of immigration across the Mexican border. And I think that I completely agree with you that the idea that you're going to have mass deportations of immigrants already here is both, you know, inhumane and unlikely to ever happen. And I'm also somewhat skeptical of the enforced attrition theory that a lot of immigration restrictionists have, that you don't need to deport them, that if you have tough enough employer sanctions, eventually the people who are here will go home. That said, my sense of, you know, attempts to control the border is less that it's, you know, been found found impossible and more that it's been found difficult and left untried. It's something where, yes, you know, the U.S.-Mexican border is an extremely long border, and there's a large wage disjunction on the two sides of it, and you're going to have people trying to get through, and you're going to have a certain level of illegal immigration no matter what. It's unclear to me that it's necessarily the case that you need to have this level of immigration. And my own sense, I guess I'd call myself a moderate restrictionist, is that, yes, at some point it was inevitable that the 12 to 15 million Mexican Americans here were going to be amnestied in some way or another. I think that what the Republican Party's play here should have been, and is to attempt, you know, to do in part what the House and Senate tried to do just before the 06 defeat, which is, you know, pass a bill that attempts to impose serious restrictions, attempts to seriously get control of the border, see what happens, and if you see immigration levels going down, then you take up the second half of comprehensive reform. What's likely to happen with this compromise is the reverse, that the various attempts to beef up employer sanctions and border security are going to sort of slip away the way they did after the 1986 amnesty, leaving you just with the amnesty and nothing else.
Well, there's... Now, this is something where my understanding of the technologies that are on offer are that you can do something significant to make it more difficult to for people to cross the border, but that you know, so if you're basically talking about boosting it up from getting on sort of maybe 10 or 15% to 20 or 25%, and if you're in a situation where basically there are tens of thousands of people who want to cross over every year, you know, so there's very little which you can do unless you're prepared to take again steps that are going to be, at the very least, extremely controversial and probably downright scandalous, of, you know, sort of imposing serious prison sentences upon people for trying to get in, rather than sort of catch and release or catch and keep for a couple of months and then release policies which are on the table. You know, so it's pretty clear that the technologies are improving in terms of allowing people to detect people crossing the border, but it also seems to me to be equally clear that technology is not, at any foreseeable point in the future, or in the near to immediate future, going to offer a solution to this problem. It might offer, from your point of view as a moderate restrictionist, a kind of a band-aid on the problem, but I don't think it's really going to have all that much of a substantial impact on the bottom line here.
I guess I'm just, well, I would be curious, for instance, to see what happened, to give it, for instance, a year and a half after you put up, you know, there were funds appropriated to build several hundred miles of walls, you know, along the border. Now, is that going to substantially affect the problem? Who knows? But it hasn't been tried. The only places where it has been tried, it's been successful, but, of course, it tends to just push migration into more dangerous areas, into the deserts and so forth. But I guess it seems to me, and it seems to many people on the restrictionist side, that, you know, there's the sort of talking point that you can't control the border. But in terms of manpower spending and willingness to attempt things like, you know, substantial fencing, nothing gets tried for, you know, very understandable reason that there's a broad coalition of forces in American politics who don't want to see any of it get tried. And my sense of Bush in particular, to get to your earlier point about what Bush and Roe were thinking, I mean, I think in part, and, you know, in a sense this speaks well of the president, that I think he really does see this as a moral issue. And I think he, you know, he is resistant to doing more to beef up security along the border because he thinks it's, you know, there are people who want to come to America to work, and he thinks they should be able to come to America to work. Which is, Mickey Kaus over at Slate keeps comparing this to the Iraq War, and I think there is something there in the sense that there is sort of, you know, the president's, you could argue the president's heart is in the right place, but what that means in practice is a sort of ill-thought-out policy on the ground. But, yeah, so I'm not sure. I guess we'll see what happens.
I guess so. Well, one interesting question, I think, for the left is to do not with the proposals for amnesty, but with the proposals for a guest worker scheme, if that actually survives through the conference committees and so on. This could be problematic in the longer term. And there's an interesting, you can play this one of two ways. One is the standard way, which New York Times plays it in an editorial, which is to suggest that a guest worker scheme with strong restrictions on how long people can stay is inhumane and a bad idea. And the other is to say that this is, in fact, something which is worthwhile, and this is something that Danny Roderick, the economist, has argued. Effectively, he says that having guest worker schemes may actually have some sort of pretty substantial positive consequences for the countries in question, you know, the countries supplying these people over the longer term in terms of remittances, sometimes in terms of these people gaining human capital, and all of these things. But where this does pose a problem for the left, I think, is that the unions on the left side have gradually come to a guardedly pro-legalization of immigrants perspective. This is something which has been a big battle for them, but which they've gradually come to accept, I think, in part because they realize that, you know, so if you hunt where the ducks are, and where the ducks are for them is in terms of, you know, so is in many of these industries where we have Latino workers who are often pretty horribly abused. You know, so the Tar Heel plant that I mentioned in Carolina being a very good example of that. But the problem for them is that if you get people coming in on guest worker schemes, then these people on guest worker schemes aren't going to be easy to unionize, and are also going to weaken the, are possibly going to undermine the working conditions for unionized workers. So it's going to be interesting to see how this debate plays out on the left. I haven't got much of a sense of that so far because nobody's quite sure how much of this is going to survive any conference committee between the House and the Senate, but it certainly poses some interesting problems for the left. My personal take on it would be that I'm probably opposed to this, if only because I think that from the point of view of the left, the fact that the U.S. is such an anomaly in terms of being an advanced industrialized society in which labor interests get such a lousy shake of the deal, I think has some sort of worldwide repercussions as well as domestic repercussions. And I think to the extent that if this ever became normalized as something which really had a sort of substantial economic impact, involving perhaps hundreds of thousands or millions of people, I think that this would be a very bad idea in terms of the not only the bargaining power of labor within the U.S., but also in terms of the power of the left within the U.S. to articulate an agenda which is somewhat different from the global agenda that is being, to a greater or lesser extent, dictated by business today.
Well, I mean, I agree. I think that's the way the left should look at it as well. I mean, again, coming from the right, I think I keep using the term, but worst of both worlds. But I think a guest worker program really is the worst of both worlds. It gives you, in a sense, everything that the right is not everything that the right is concerned about, but a lot of what the right is concerned about in terms of the possibility for balkanization, for a sort of unassimilated minority within the borders of the United States who are, you know, at once doing all the things that low-skilled immigrants do, particularly driving down wages for native-born workers, while at the same time are resentful of their position for understandable reasons within U.S. society. So it's giving you that, while at the same time, you know, it's not doing what the left wants us to do with immigration law, which is essentially to, you know, ensure that, that people who are coming here are getting the kind of shape that people who are in the United States deserve. And it seems like that's a pressure point where opponents on the left and the right of the immigration package should be able to push. But it's interesting. There was an article today in the New York Times, you know, that this, the guest worker provision is understood, I think, just and rightly so, as a way to get business interests, chamber of commerce groups, and so on, definitely on board with this bill. And the article suggested that, you know, these groups are actually now balking, of course, at the very limited attempts at, you know, forcing employers to verify where their workers are coming from and so forth. So it'll definitely, I think it's far from clear that this bill is going to sail through the Senate. But yes, guest workers, it just seems like a terrible idea to me on a lot of different levels.
Yeah, but also it is probably the one part of the bill. The thing that the employers seem to be balking at, as you say, is partly the enforcement, which has been extraordinarily lax under the Bush administration. It's been very clear that until, I think, pretty well right before the November 04 elections, the various employers were being more or less encouraged to do whatever the hell they wanted. But it seems to me that the employers, their main interest, or their main worry about the thing, is with regard to H-1B visas, which where the proposal is for a scheme that would effectively remove much of the control over who gets in on a H-1B visa from employers and bring it to the state, which is something like more like, as I understand it, the system that works in Canada and Australia. And they're worried that this will mean that, you know, sort of skilled labour in particular is going to have some difficulty in, that they're going to have some difficulty in particular in dealing with skilled labour. From their point of view, I think that a sort of guest worker system is, in fact, it's a pretty good deal. I haven't seen any particular references from business to the guest worker scheme, which would suggest that they're opposed to that. And it effectively provides them with a captive workforce that probably is not going to enjoy the same kind of bargaining power that does that native U.S. workforce would, and that doesn't have any expectations over the longer term of gaining that bargaining power through citizenship and through full participation in politics. So it will be interesting to see what happens. If businesses are sort of signaling, and this is one thing that I wasn't able to get from the New York Times article, whether business is saying that this needs to be changed or whether business is indicating that they think that this bill is so much of a dog's dinner that they don't want to get it passed at all. But it could end up that business end up losing very badly on a whole bunch of fronts, depending on the way that this actually comes out. I understand that the House bill is being drafted by somebody from Silicon Valley, so one would imagine that a bunch of the provisions with regard to skilled workers and H-1Bs are probably going to be rather different in the House bill, and again, how that gets resolved in conference, assuming that both of these bills come through, is going to be a very interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding, I'm just seeing if I can pull up the Times piece, my understanding was, yeah, the business groups weren't saying that, you know, it's a dog's dinner, we aren't going to support it. They were saying, well, you know, we would need to have, you know, fewer employer sanctions built into it. But what would be interesting is if some of those employer sanctions were taken out, then you might start to lose some of the cover from Republicans, you know,
exactly.
John Kyle Republicans who are right now giving the Democrats cover. I mean, right now the Democrats are, you know, the Democratic leadership is in a good situation because the bill is tearing apart the Republican Party and so far isn't tearing apart the Democrats. But it's not impossible to imagine that situation reversing itself in some way. Maybe we should turn our attention to another aspect of conservatism in disarray, which I think you wanted to talk about, the phenomenon of conservapedia.
Yeah, which is, to me, interesting and depressing, because let me start out with my priors here. I vehemently disagree with conservatives on a whole bunch of different issues. There are some segments of the conservative movement which I find to be extremely problematic and distressing and to some extent morally reprehensible. There are other parts of the conservative movement that I find to be people who I sometimes have compelling and interesting and useful arguments, but it seems to me that what the conservapedia thing suggests is that there is a whole wing of the conservative party which is effectively giving up on the public space, which is effectively taking its ball home and refusing to play anymore. Because if you look at the history, and here I'm thinking of Godfrey Hodgson in a very interesting book which came out about 10 years back on the history of the conservative movement, and his basic argument is that this really begins Yes, if you have conservatives who are more or less quietistic, you know, they're concerned with some sort of the cultivation of their private life, of family life, of whatever, and what really gets them going is when you get all of these decisions made about education back in the 1970s, which really begin to push back against homeschooling, against the possibility of conservatives maintaining a space of their own, and that's the stage at which they become galvanized and begin to start trying to reshape the public space as well. Now, there are obviously different people who have different accounts of this, but at least I think a significant part of the conservative movement did get galvanized by that particular set of events. What this suggests to me is that the conservative movement is now beginning to retreat to a certain extent from the public space, and rather than dealing with people who disagree with them in the cut and thrust of debate and whatever, is trying to construct what only seems like a kind of a rather peculiar mental universe of their own, in which they don't necessarily have to deal with critics. They don't necessarily have to deal with people who disagree with them profoundly on this, that, and the other. And, you know, some of these people, frankly, I'm very happy to see withdrawing from the public sphere, but also I would like to see a reasonably intellectually strong, thoughtful, conservative movement so that guys like me will have somebody to argue with. And so I worry sometimes when I see this kind of stuff that maybe the conservative movement not only is in disarray, but is beginning to fail systematically at an intellectual level, which I think is clearly a problem for you guys, but also maybe is a problem for us guys in the long run, too.
Yeah, I mean,
I would people to argue with.
I'd be wary of overstating. I was trying to figure out just how big and significant Conservapedia is, because I thought when it was started that its entries were quickly overrun by commenters from liberal blogs writing in ridiculous things and so on, which suggested that maybe it was just 30 guys around the country trying to put something together. It does seem to have, they claim to have 10,000 entries now. I'm at the entry for Jesus Christ, which begins, "Jesus Christ is the only Son of God who in the fullness of time was sent by God the Father to be the expiation for our sins and to ransom us from death." This is a point that I agree with, but I do see that it might be somewhat problematic as the beginning for an encyclopedia entry. But I think that as to the broader point, I think that the history of conservatism in the U.S. over the last 30 years has been a sort of an attempt to split the difference in a way between, on the one hand, trying to infiltrate and thrive in the larger, often liberal-dominated institutions of American culture, particularly, the mass media, the universities, Hollywood, and so forth, and complete withdrawal into sort of small conservative communes or something where, you'd raise your kids far from the blandishments of secular America. And what conservatives have done is try and sort of chart a middle course and build up alternative institutions that challenge, if a conservative academic can't get tenure at Harvard, he gets a chair at the American Enterprise Institute. If a conservative reporter doesn't have a job at Newsweek, he'll have a job at the Weekly Standard. If a conservative anchor can't get on ABC News, he'll be, running Fox News and so on. And I think the right has been very successful in this. I think one of the things that you see in the Bush administration is the limits of this approach. And I think I agree with your point about, the problem this creates intellectually for the conservative movement. I think conservatives are always going after liberals for having this echo chamber mentality. People talk about cocooning in the liberal press, this phenomenon where, it's the famous Pauline Kael, "nobody I knew voted for Nixon" phenomenon, where because you don't know any conservatives, because there aren't any conservatives in your business, you persistently misread the world, misread the American electorate, and so on. And the problem is conservatives have created the same phenomenon on a smaller, more constricted scale. So you have an echo chamber effect, but it's a smaller echo chamber, so you're getting even less of the world filtering in some cases. And I think you could see this most explicitly in the way conservatives reacted to media coverage of the Iraq War. And, conservatives have an automatic response to, media reports about Republican policies, which is to say, well, the media is votes 90% for the Democrats, therefore they're never going to give us a fair shake, therefore you can discount 60% of what they're saying. And, you know, often this is true, and there is a sense in which, you know, the fact that R.W. Apple could take the pages of the New York Times a week into the war in Afghanistan and proclaim that it was a quagmire and another Vietnam and so on is an example of a place where conservatives are right that there are problems in the media. However, over time, it became clear that the New York Times' coverage of the war in Iraq was much more accurate than, you know, the good news from Iraq bulletins that you get in National Review or something. And the fact, I think, that the fact that the Bush administration took so long to change course in any way in Iraq, I think, is indicative of how this cocooning plays out in the real world.
Yeah, well, I guess the war in Iraq, because when you were saying that the Conservapedia is a relatively small movement, I think that that's true. But I was what worried me about, and this is something that my co-blogger John Quiggin posted about, is that it is suggestive of a larger phenomenon, and the war in Iraq, I think, is a great example of that. You know, so if I look back at the early days of the war in Iraq, when I wanted to read somebody who came from a sort of smart alternative position to me, I'd look to somebody like maybe Greg Derigian, who does Belgravia Dispatch, mm-hmm. or to my friend Dan Dresner, who's a libertarian with some conservative tendencies, depending on whether the month has an R in it or whatever. And, you know, these would give me things that I disagreed with, but occasionally I would think, okay, maybe I'm a little bit, you know, so maybe I'm a little bit overblown in my in how I see the war in Iraq. Maybe there's an alternative perspective here. But what I've seen over the last couple of years is how everybody who I viewed as being in touch with reality has begun to realize this, and you see people like Derigian more or less becoming vehement critics of the Bush administration, but also you see the conservative, a lot of conservatives and a lot of people in the blogosphere in particular, basically circling the wagons and pretending that nothing is wrong, and to the extent that it is wrong, it's because of the those evil folks in Congress who are trying to stab American troops in the back. And that's something which is really, really deeply intellectually unhealthy. You know, so I do get the impression of a lot of conservatives creating their own little mental universe in which they don't have to deal with the fact that they are wrong on many of the many major factual issues, and don't necessarily have the wherewithal to come together and to create an alternative view of things. And this may also be happening with regard to immigration. So when I look at the conservative movement now, to some extent I'm reminded of the last days of the British Conservative Party under John Major, where you basically had vicious internecine battles over, in this case, the European Union. You had a whole bunch of crazies taking over the party, and you basically had the party retreating from public life for 10 or 12 years, so that they weren't able to offer anything which seemed even vaguely attractive to voters. They became identified as being, quote, the nasty party, unquote. They started running stuff which was more or less just of appeals to people's innate racism as part of their campaigns in for political office, and they really found themselves in very bad shape, with, I think, consequent negative effects for British politics. You know, so when you've got one party which effectively doesn't have a real opposition, then that party can do a lot of stuff, some of which maybe isn't necessarily the best stuff that party should be doing. And I worry that the Conservative movement in general, and the Republican Party, as to some extent the representative of the Conservative movement, is maybe moving more in that direction than should be.
Yeah, I mean it's tough to say. I have that inclination as well, and as a conservative, I tend towards pessimism. It's worth remembering that, you know, it was just 2.5 years ago that Karl Rove was a genius. The Democrats were in complete disarray, and, you know, people were talking about the Democratic Party falling apart and being dragged into complete irrelevance and so on. I mean, I think one of the lessons of the last 2.5 years is that nothing is quite as definitive as it seems in a country that's still pretty much split 50-50. I mean, I think that, you know, the Republicans in the Bush era had a chance to break the 50-50 deadlock and become a 55-45 majority, and they blew that chance. And now the Democrats have that chance, and maybe they'll succeed, and maybe this will prove a sort of Blair major moment. Maybe that's what 08 will prove. I think and hope it's a little too soon to tell. But yeah.
Well, where do you see a possible Republican resurgence coming from? I'm not seeing it.
Well, I don't see it in 08. I think that the Republican Party has, well, I think it has, particularly on the presidential level, voters are, if you look at the polls, for instance, both Rudy Giuliani and John McCain run either very competitively or ahead of all the major Democratic contenders. I think that suggests that there are wells of support for the Republicans at the national level that haven't yet run dry. Now, I'm skeptical that either, that particularly McCain, but also Giuliani, would actually beat a Hillary Clinton or a Barack Obama. I think 08 is definitely going to be a Democratic year. But no, I mean, I think my sense is that the conservative movement in particular, also the broader GOP, is headed towards a crossroads. And I think the choices that are made in the next 2 to 4 years are going to determine whether the party spends, you know, 6 months to 2 years in the wilderness or whether it spends 5 to 15 years. I think, you know, it's, if you look at the Democrats, the amount of time that elapsed from, you know, what a lot of people regard as liberalism's debacle in 1968 and 1972 to Bill Clinton, the sort of moment when, in a certain sense, liberalism starts to revive, that's a 20-year stretch, during which time the Democrats held Congress for the most part. But it was certainly a conservative era, understood to be a conservative era, and the Democrats were in disarray for a very long time. And it's possible the same thing could happen on the right. I hope it doesn't, but...
Yeah, no, well, I just don't see, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe there's something which is going to emerge over the next couple of years, but I see a lot of confusion on the right. And also the other thing, you know, so getting back to what you said about these sort of two strands within the Conservative Party, you know, so the movement building strand, the strand of wanting to get involved in politics, and the more, you know, sort of pietistic, quietistic strand of, you know, sort of wanting to cultivate, you know, sort of private space away. It seems to me that there's a there's always been that strand, and the latter strand has often attracted some of the smarter conservative ideologues. I mean, if you read, sort of, for example, David Frum's Dead Right, you know, so the final pages of that book are all about how the conservatives need to have that period in the wilderness in order to regain their purity and in order to regain some sense of what it is that they actually are looking for. And so so it seems to me quite possible or plausible that the smarter people in the Conservative Party are going to find that attractive in a certain sense, that it may make better sense for them to be out of power for a while because, you know, frankly, some of the people who they have struck a bargain with in order to get the power and to maintain it have not been the people who they should have been. Sorry, I've just had a phone call coming in, but you get the point.
Yes, it's totally fine.
Hi, this is Henry. I'm not interested
in calling. Let's see. I lost my train of thought there for a second. I was going to say, you know, there's this strain appears. It appeared after the 1998 impeachment of Bill Clinton, and Paul Weyrich, this major conservative activist, wrote a famous piece saying that cultural conservatives, in particular, needed to, you know, stop thinking that American culture would be transformed through political means and that they needed to, you know, go into the wilderness. I think one thing to remember, though, is that the Republican Party, particularly in this, you know, obviously there's a distinction between the conservative movement and the Republican Party, but the Republican Party remains the party of middle America in a very fundamental way. It's the party of, you know, if you look at the numbers, white, married, church-going people with families. And this is a potent reserve of political strength. And I'd be somewhat skeptical of the idea that the Republicans are going to drop anywhere near as far as you know, the Tories did. Now, obviously, you're dealing with very different political systems, too, in America and Britain that allows. But, you know, it used to be in American politics that parties would drop to levels like the British Tories did in the 1990s. If, you know, the Republicans during the Roosevelt administration had a, you know, a tiny fraction of seats in the House and the Senate. I guess I'll stay agnostic on this point as to what's going to happen. I mean, I have my own, obviously, set of ideas about where I think the Republican Party should go, and I think that it should move in directions that, on the domestic policy that George W. Bush tried to move it in somewhat unsuccessfully and somewhat ham-handedly towards a more, towards an understanding that its base is increasingly working class, for instance, that, you know, you
well,
can't,
as I understand
old,
what
the old tax cuts, you know, but go ahead, sorry.
No, just as I understand, I mean, basically you've been pushing for is something which is a little more like European-style Christian democracy as a basis for republicanism. Is that accurate?
To a certain extent, yeah. I think, you know, yeah, if you wanted to get into the weeds, I think there are some big distinctions. And I think that, you know, conservatism, any kind of sort of reformed conservatism has to be attuned to the difference between, you know, the difference between America and Europe, and attuned towards preserving features of American life that, you know, it had oriented around the free market in particular, and sort of ideas of independence and sort of reduced state oversight that are very different from the European context. But I think that certainly addressing the set of issues that European Christian democratic parties tend to address, the sort of intersection between, you know, families, the welfare state, and so on. That's the direction I think that the Republicans should be pushing in. But I think that it's all, so much of American politics, for good reason, has been caught up in the debate over the Iraq War, that I think, you know, all, and you see this on the Republican side, where, you know, the Republican base is concerned about the Iraq War and the war on terrorism, broadly construed, far more than any other issue. And so there really isn't any incentive in this election cycle for Republican candidates to, you know, be reformist in various ways on domestic policy, try and break with conservative doctrine, because the only thing that really matters is which candidate can appear tough enough on the war. And, you know, until we reach some kind of resolution in Iraq, that's going to continue to be the central issue on the Republican side, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. Maybe we should move on to the next topic, which is John Ashcroft, good guy or not, and I believe you posted on your blog about this recently.
Yeah, well, and this is, we don't have to talk very long about this, but just the point that I was making on the blog is, you know, there's been a lot of strange new respect for John Ashcroft of late, because it turns out that, you know, he was more resistant to some of the Bush administration's more, shall we say, creative interpretations of law and executive power than people previously knew. And he was, you know, there's this story circulating now about how he rose from his hospital bed to bat down a suggestion pushed by Dick Cheney's office I think it's one of the wiretapping programs be allowed to go forward in spite of the fact that the opinion of the White House counsel's office was that it was illegal. And, you know, so Ashcroft is emerging as, you know, shockingly as a defender of civil liberties rather than the caricature of him that circulated over the past 4 to 6 years. And the point I was making was just that, you know, the press's reaction to Ashcroft from the beginning, I think, was colored very strongly by the fact that he belonged to what is viewed, perhaps rightly, as a very weird Protestant sect, you know, the Assemblies of God, which includes prohibitions on dancing, which is something most Americans find somewhat weird and reporters find very weird. And Ashcroft, you know, there was this incident where he reported that he'd been anointed with Crisco before becoming governor of Missouri by his pastor, or maybe by his father. I'm not sure if I'm getting
the story wrong. His father, if my memory serves me.
Yeah. So Ashcroft was a weird and, you know, religiously zealous figure, and he got an intense amount of bad press and became the villain of the Bush administration. And obviously liberals aren't going to like a figure like John Ashcroft. He is a conventional social conservative, fiscally conservative Republican who took an aggressive approach to restrictions on civil liberties after 9/11. The point I was making was that, you know, in hindsight, it's clear that Ashcroft was one of the more professional and independent-minded figures in the Bush administration, and that, you know, actually it was figures like Dick Cheney who didn't get bad press for a very long time into this administration and who were viewed as, you know, very sensible, sort of almost wise man type figures who turned out to be the most aggressive and the most bungling of all the Bushies. And I think that there's a lesson here for reporters in particular, but also for liberals in general on, you know, just sort of thinking through who you make your enemies and not assuming that the worst people in the administration are the people who are the culturally most distant from you.
Well, in terms of thinking through enemies, you know, so the way I think about it is a little different. That somebody like Ashcroft, and you know, I have pretty mixed feelings about Ashcroft because it seems to me that, and this is based to some extent on stuff in the public records, to some extent on talking to people who've had interactions with him of one sort or another, that his religion and his politics intersected in ways which maybe sort of conducted him towards, how can I put it, conducted him towards views of what was politically appropriate that weren't necessarily the kinds of rational views that you might like to see. But I think that the key distinction here, and maybe this is what you're trying to get at, is that in the end of the day, sort of Ashcroft wasn't a hack in the way that perhaps some people thought he was. He was somebody who clearly, somebody like me, would disagree with vehemently, would not want to see within 100 miles of political power, but nonetheless somebody who one could sort of view at the very least as being perhaps an enemy, but an honourable enemy. And I think somebody like Sam Brownback, sort of to some extent, inspires the same feelings in me. And also in Matt Iglesias, who I think talked about this in Blogging Heads some weeks ago, that on the one hand, Brownback is somebody whose views on a whole bunch of things I would not like to see in 100 years implemented as U.S. policy. But on the other hand, unlike many other Republicans of a strongly denominational persuasion, he also puts his money where his mouth is in terms of seeking to push for sort of greater foreign aid, you know, sort of taking very seriously his duties as a Christian in the public sphere, in a sense where that perhaps some other Republicans maybe at the very least don't say, you know, sort of that their consciences seem to align rather more conveniently with their pocketbooks. The other people I think are sort of deserve some admiration. Somebody, Jack Goldsmith, I think, is somebody who really deserves a lot of praise here. He was clearly the guy who managed to get this ball rolling in the first place. But when he came in, and he's somebody who again has strongly right-wing views, but on a bunch of things, but clearly recognised that this was that whatever policy this is, and this is something which we still don't know very much about, was something he felt was unconstitutional. Managed to persuade Comey and Ashcroft of his case for this, and then after clearly left the Bush administration shortly after having managed to do this, one suspects that he was pushed out to some greater or lesser degree, and then faced a lot of animus from his academic colleagues who accused him of effectively being one of the people who had facilitated all sorts of bad things, whereas the best that we know is that both on this issue of wiretapping and also on the issues to do with torture, he seems to have been one of the people within the administration who perceived his conservative values as being something which would lead him to respect due process and to argue against some of the more ideologically loaded versions of presidential power which were being bruited around by people like John Yoo. So people like that, I think, certainly me as somebody who comes from a very different political perspective, I don't want to see these people win. I do have a considerable degree more political respect for these people than I have for the people who are frankly more hackish when it comes to their, to aligning their political beliefs with whatever is either politically convenient or in some cases economically convenient.
Yeah, I mean, I think Matt's Matt Iglesias' point here is the best one, and is what I was sort of fumbling towards. That, you know, in a democracy like the United States, that is a two-party system, for some percentage of the time, the reins of government are going to be in the hands of people who you find, you know, politically distasteful for a variety of reasons. During those times, what you want, you want people in power who are professional and honorable and, you know, devoted to principle and the rule of law, rather than people who are primarily, you know, defined by their hackishness and by their devotion to the person in power. And I think that's, you know, the difference between John Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez is the difference between a, you know, a conservative who was also a distinguished public servant, and a conservative who became Attorney General primarily because he was friends with George W. Bush. And also the point that, you know, John Ashcroft may have crazy religious beliefs and they may impact his politics in various ways, but I think one of the lessons of the Bush administration is that people are inclined to do crazy things. They're as likely to do crazy things for secular reasons as for religious reasons. And I think Dick Cheney is, as far as I can tell, not a particularly pious man, but he's been associated with some of the stranger decisions of this administration, without having God whispering in his ear telling him what to do. Yeah. But anyway, so speaking of God, shall we finish up with the question of Roman Catholicism in the West, a small topic?
Yeah, well, I guess you had a post which I somewhat disagreed with, and this was the last week or so, where you basically wrote about how it was that Catholics and sort of, and indeed other people in public culture, very often absorb a view of Catholicism which and Catholicism's historical role, which has been written by the other side, which has been written by the secularists. And I'm speaking of somebody who comes from, you know, so I'm Irish, I grew up, I was educated for a pretty painful part, a number of years by the Christian Brothers in a small town in County Tipperary, Ireland. And believe me, I got on sort of about as much Catholic triumphalist versions of revisionist history as you could possibly hope for. And it was not exactly it was pretty intellectually stifling. And I think that there's a broader sort of thing here which I'd like to push you on a little bit, which is, in some ways, you know, sort of Catholic Ireland in the 70s and 80s seems like a sort of a conservative paradise, you know, sort of the time that I grew up effectively. You know, so you have a strong attachment to piety in public life, you have you have religion playing an extraordinarily large role and sort of very high church attendance rates, and you also have a political system where the voice of the Catholic Church is extremely powerful. And speaking as somebody who grew up as a Catholic during this period, this was not a very attractive or happy place to live. And I suspect that you and most other people who have grown up in America during the 1980s and 1990s wouldn't especially like to be transported in a time machine back to Ireland during this period and to see what it was like. Because it's not, when you have a sort of religion playing such a strong role in politics, what you get is a very stifling public atmosphere, you know, sort of in which, bluntly, there's a hell of a lot of hypocrisy, a hell of a lot of stuff that goes on that never gets reported because it's not in the interests either of the church or of the political establishment, which are very often working in cahoots with each other. And you get an intellectual atmosphere in which debate is fundamentally stifled because certain points of view are deliberately and systematically excluded. There's one very famous case involving an Irish intellectual, Hubert Butler, who mildly opined at one stage that Archbishop Stepanek in Croatia, who was then being imprisoned by the communist authorities, had been a little close to the Nazis during during the period of the Nazi occupation, and found himself being ostracized from Irish intellectual life in his hometown and elsewhere for the remaining 30 or 40 years of his life. And this is it's not a very pleasant environment to grow up in. There are certain parts of the old Ireland that I regret, I'm sorry, that they have disappeared in the economic growth and prosperity of the last 10 or 15 years. But I just would be interested to hear, what is your ideal society as a conservative, and in what ways, you know, sort of is this something which is acceptable to you as a necessary trade-off? what kind of society do you want to live in?
Well,
And how would you convince somebody like me, who grew up in a pretty conservative society, that this is in fact better than what we have in the U.S. today?
Well, just to start with, I guess the original point I was making wasn't necessarily to argue that, you know, the United States would be better served if we had a narrative of Catholic triumphalism dominating public life. It was more to suggest that, you know, particularly as Catholics, but also Protestants, secularists, Jews, and so forth, should be aware that Anglo-America is steeped in, you know, a narrative of Protestant triumphalism, which is much less stifling today than it was in, say, the England of 1807, where, you know, a Catholic wouldn't be allowed to vote, but remains persistent in subtle ways. And it was the post was written about a Sherwin Newland in the New Republic reviewed a book about a history of dissection and talked about, you know, hearing people talk about how, you know, the Catholic Church in the 16th century stood in the way of dissection and, you know, wouldn't allow artists to draw the human body and all this stuff, none of which is true. And in fact, the popes were major patrons of dissection and so forth. So that was the micro point, was that, you know, there are these narratives in our society that associate the Catholic Church throughout history with backwardness, whether that's fair or not, and that, you know, Americans need to be aware of the background in which by which their society is shaped. Now, as to the larger question, I'm not sure what I think the ideal society is, and I went through a phase in college, like a number of conservatives, I think, particularly in the American context, a number of at least intellectual conservatives, I don't think this is a mass phenomenon, of sort of an Evelyn Waugh style pining for the lost glories of, you know, aristocracy and so forth, the great Catholic families of the British Isles and so on. And I think in hindsight that sort of gets you into a terrain of the kind of conservatives who sit around drinking brandy and wearing bow ties and, you know, assuming that Bryce had revisited as the be-all and end-all of Western literature, and there's definitely something a little bit immature about that point of view, and I certainly think that liberalism in general, and liberal pluralism of the kind that exists in the United States and didn't exist in Ireland in the 1970s has been good for Catholicism in certain ways, and that the story of the last 200 years of church-state relationships in Catholic countries is not at all a pretty one in many respects, and it's clear that, you know, the church is better served by Popes John Paul and Benedict, who are committed to, ideals of religious freedom and so on, than it was served by many of the 19th century popes. So that's where I would start out. From there, I guess I would go forward a bit more and say that, you know, there clearly are ways, not clearly, from a conservative point of view, there are ways in which the pendulum can swing too far in the other direction and, you know, towards a sense of, you know, alienation, fragmentation, and so forth, in which issues of religion are... By separating church and state, the original liberal theory was, you separate church and state at the political level, and this will allow for the flourishing of religious pluralism and the flourishing of religious debate and so forth. What I think you get in Western countries is the extension too often of political liberalism into the cultural and intellectual realm, where political liberalism says no church shall impose its teachings on people who don't agree with them. When that's extended into the cultural and intellectual realm, it becomes a kind of soft but also oppressive relativism, where it's assumed that debates about religious truth aren't really worth having, and that, you know, it's not... These are concerns that should be bracketed in not only in the political sphere but in the cultural sphere as well. Every religion's just as good as any other religion, and there's very little value in any kind of sort of adherence to traditional religious beliefs. But you know, I can go on at length. But do you want to chime in?
Well, I'm running out of tape here. This is the last blowing your heads that I'm going to have to do on tape. But quickly, quick thing, Yosef. What you seem to be suggesting here is that you're kind of a conservative pluralist, in a sense, that you feel that a plural society is good, but maybe this pendulum has swung too far against religion. How can you be both a conservative who holds to fundamental values about what is right and what is wrong, and be a pluralist who believes that there are different people who have different points of view, and that maybe these points of view may... in other words, how can you be attracted to a pluralist political space without falling into the kinds of relativism that you seem to object to here?
Well, I think that you can make a distinction between a pluralist political space and... I think there's a distinction between political pluralism and intellectual relativism. And I'm not sure precisely where that distinction falls. I think that, you know, and political pluralism is obviously... I'm just gathering my thoughts a little bit at the moment. I mean, I think that to a certain extent, every society has orthodoxies of one kind or another that are enforced to varying degrees. And I think that, you know, American society in the late 20th and early 21st century at the elite level is shaped by forces. You know, to take one for instance, the Pope has a book out about Jesus of Nazareth. If you read the Newsweek review of the Pope's book, it's filled with what are, to my mind, a large number of ridiculous statements about how, you know, it's how this book will appeal to the extremely small number of believers who, you know, can believe in science and rationalism while also believing in the possibility that, you know, the resurrection of Christ actually happened. So this, to me, the idea that, you know, that it is incompatible to both believe in Galileo's theory of the solar system and the possibility that Christ rose from the dead is an example of what happens when political pluralism shades too far into an intellectual relativism that denies the possibility of religion being true.
Well, I'm going to run out of tape now, so we'll have to...
We shouldn't have saved this discussion for the end, clearly.
Yeah, there's a lot more to say. But great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Henry.